Hello, everyone. My name is Ayça Çubukçu. I'm an assistant professor in human rights at the London School of Economics. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the school today. And on behalf of the Center for the Study of Human Rights and the Middle East Center, which will be co-sponsoring our panel today, the event is titled Legal Ordering, Citizenship and Human Rights, the Case of the Palestinian Citizens of Israel. And it will feature our speakers, Dr. Mazen Masri of the City Law School, City University of London, who will speak for about 30 minutes regarding his new book, which the talk will be based on. And our discussant will be Yoav Pellet, who's a visiting professor at the Middle East Center here at LSE. This event, let me note, is being audio recorded, and technology permitting, we'll have a podcast posted online in a few days. So if you'd like to be mindful of your comments for the recording, please do so. Audience members are encouraged to comment on the event on Twitter, and the suggested hashtag of the event is hashtag LSE Palestinians. Of course, you're free to come up with your own hashtag as well. Our speakers today, as I mentioned, are Dr. Mazen Masri, who is a senior lecturer in law at the City Law School since September 2013. He has previously taught at the University of Toronto and York University in Canada. Mazen's areas of teaching and research are constitutional law and public international law, with special interests in comparative constitutionalism, constitutional theory, human rights law, and equality. Mazen's scholarly work explores the interaction between law and broader social, political, and economic questions. His current research explores the role of settler colonialism in shaping law. In addition to law, Mazen has an interest in the theory and practice of academic freedom. Dr. Masri's work has appeared in legal and interdisciplinary journals such as Social and Legal Studies, Asian Journal of International Law, and International Journal of Law in Context, as well as in scholarly e-zines and blogs. His book, which we will be discussing today, is titled The Dynamics of Exclusionary Constitutionalism, Israel as a Jewish and Democratic State. It was published in 2017 as part of Hart Studies in Comparative Public Law series. Dr. Masri obtained his LLB degree from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and his LLM degree from the University of Toronto. He received his PhD from Osgoode Hall Law School of York University in Toronto. His doctoral studies were partially funded through a fellowship from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, which is a very prestigious award. Mazen is a qualified lawyer and a member of the Israeli Bar Association. He has worked as a lawyer and consultant and has served as a legal advisor to the Negotiation Affairs Department of the Palestine Liberation Organization. We're very pleased to have you today here at LSE. Thank you for coming. Our discussing today is Professor Yoav Pellet, who is a Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Tel Aviv University. In 2016 and 17, he was a Leverhulme Professorial Fellow in the School of Global Studies at the University of Sussex. Professor Pellet's book, co-authored with Gershon Shafir, is called Being Israeli, The Dynamics of Multiple Citizenship, which was published by the Cambridge University Press in 2002 and won the Albert Hourani Award of the Middle East Studies Association of North America for Best Book in Middle Eastern Studies, published in that year. He is co-author with Horit Herman Pellet of The Religionization of Israeli Society and co-editor with John Ehrenberg of Israel and Palestine, Alternative Perspectives on Statehood, which was published by Roman and Littlefield in 2016. He's also a member of the editorial boards of Ethnic and Racial Studies and Citizenship Studies, two of the best journals in the field. Yoav has held visiting appointments at the University of Virginia, the New School for Social Research in New York City, the University of Pennsylvania, Rutgers University and the University of California at San Diego, among many others. He's also a licensed attorney in Israel, and he specializes in labor law. Without further ado, I would like to give the floor to our speakers. And as I mentioned, this event is being audio recorded for your attention. Mazen?
Well, thank you, Ayça. And thanks. I would like to also to thank the Human Rights Center and the Middle East Center and Hanin also especially for organizing this event. And also thank Professor Pillard for taking the time to comment on the book, especially that
Can you hear our speaker? Sorry.
I admire the work of Professor Pillard, and indeed I also use it in my own work. So the central question of the talk today and the central question of the book is Israel's definition as a Jewish and democratic state, which is the definition that the state boasts of and is taken for granted by many. But then what does this definition actually mean? And this question is actually very broad and complex. And one way of actually thinking about it is to divide it into two levels. The first level is the national level, where we have a situation where there's a contradiction between the inclusiveness of democracy and the exclusion by defining the state in ethno-religious terms. And the second level is the religious term, since Judaism also, or Jewishness, also indicates or has a religious aspect. Mm-hmm. And there's always a tension between religion and democracy, which tends to limit the role of religion. Of course, this division is not pure. There's a lot of overlap between the two, since many of the definitions overlap. But for the sake of this talk, I'm going to focus on the first level, the national level, especially that in Israel, about 20% of the population, of the citizens of the state, are Palestinian, officially known by the state as Arab Israelis. And they are the remaining segment of the Palestinian population, the rest of whom live either in the occupied Palestinian territories, West Bank and the Gaza Strip, or as refugees in exile. This native population is not Jewish. And this poses a challenge to the definition of the state, which is defined as Jewish. So what I'm going to do today is examine the definition with this challenge in mind. And for the rest of this talk, unless otherwise pointed out, I'm going to, every time I refer to Palestinian, I mean Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. Now, I'm going to start with an anecdote here. And maybe I should... I don't think this works.
I'll do it. What?
Next one, please. Okay, so today I'm going to just first take you to this area here in the south of Israel, Naqab in Arabic, Negev in Hebrew, and we're going just to look at a number of villages in this area here. And the first one is the village of, maybe I should just go there if the microphone
Yeah, sure.
Works. Yes. So the first village is the village of Atir Emel Hiran, which is a village that has a population of 1,000. The inhabitants are Bedouins who are Israeli citizens, and they have lived in their village since 1957 after the Israeli army forced them to relocate, to leave their original lands and move to this new location. Now, despite the fact that they were forced into this area by the Israeli army, this village is unrecognized, which means that it does not get recognition by the state as a village that exists where people live. As such, it's not connected to the electric grid, it's not connected to the water supply, not connected to the sewage system, healthcare and education services are bare minimum, and also it does not appear on any official state map, except for one, And this state and this map, this official map, is the zoning map where the village is designated, is the area of the village is designated as the area for demolition. And the demolition here is for the purpose of clearing the land in order to build another town called Hiran, which is designated as a Jewish town. Nearby, another village called Al-Araqib, which has a population of 300. In 2010, also another unrecognized village. And in 2010, 45 structures were bulldozed, 4,500 olive trees were uprooted, and the village essentially was destroyed. The residents of the village tried to rebuild it, and they kept rebuilding it, and the state kept demolishing it. And as of January 2017, the government has demolished the village or different structures in the village for about 106 times. Now, the residents of these two villages are Palestinian and also Israeli citizens. Not very far away, we can see what's known as the single-family settlements, or also known as individual settlements. And these are large tracts of land, usually hundreds and sometimes even thousands of acres, that the state of Israel allocates to individuals or to single families for the stated purpose of development of agriculture and tourism. But in the government resolutions, where they actually do amend the decisions on the allocation, we can see that one of the main purposes, actually the main purpose, is to protect the land, or as they call the nation's land, from intruders. And the intruders being the Palestinian Bedouins, whose villages, as we saw in the earlier slide, are being destroyed. Now, these single settlements have been only allocated to Jewish citizens. They are connected to the water grid, electric grid, the water system, and many of them were originally built in breach of Israeli law, planning law. And this breach of law was retroactively rectified using or through an act of the Knesset in 2010. So what we have here is kind of two kinds of citizenships. On the one hand, we have Israeli citizens who are Palestinians. Their villages are demolished or designated for demolition. They have limited access because they're not recognized villages. No electricity, water, or sewage. Healthcare and education are minimal. And these villages are seen as illegal. On the other hand, we have the individual settlements or single-family settlements where the majority, all the inhabitants are actually Jewish Israelis. The land is allocated by the state to Jewish citizens only for the stated purpose, for the purpose of protecting the land. They receive all of the services. They are legal, and when they are technically illegal, the state acts even with retroactive legislation in order to legalize them. Now, and we can see here the role of law, the role that law plays, because all of this designation as legal and illegal is actually done by the law. We have legal institutions, we have parliament, we have the courts, we have enforcement authorities, planning authorities, all creating a situation where one area is designated as legal and the other is designated as illegal, or one kind of presence is designated as legal and the other as illegal. Now, in this context, really, the Israeli law also formally recognizes equality as part of the law. So we have here a famous quote from the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Israel, Aharon Barak, where he says that the state is a Jewish state in which minorities live, including the Arab minority. Everyone who belongs to these minorities enjoys full equal rights. And this was from a case from 2000, from the year 2000. And my interest here and the question that is really central to this book is how can this commitment to equality be reconciled with the story of the villages that I have described earlier? So how can the commitment to equality be upheld when we have the law and the institutions that make the law, adjudicate the law, and enforce it, displace one group and grant favorable rights to others? So these are the questions that I look at. So not simply pointing out double standards, but looking at how the Israeli constitutional system facilitates such outcomes through the self-definition as Jewish and democratic state. Now, the definition has two components, the Jewish aspect and the democratic aspect. Now, if we look at the democratic aspect, we can see that the state has the main markers of democracy. There's an elected parliament, there are periodic elections, rights are granted, guaranteed by law, and external bodies such as Freedom House and the OECD classify Israel as a democracy. On the other hand, if we look at the Jewish element of the definition, we'll see that the court, the Supreme Court of Israel, has designated and emphasized a number of times that the Jewish element or the Jewish definition means that the state should have a Jewish majority, and the state must preserve a Jewish majority so as to remain a Jewish state. It also means that the state should promote Jewish immigration, Jewish nationalism, Jewish culture and heritage, and Jewish settlement, and that there should be a special role for Jewish national organizations such as the Jewish National Fund and the Jewish Agency. At the same time, we can see that there is this definition and this emphasis on the Jewish character translates into discrimination for Palestinians. And we can see discrimination in all areas of policy. So whether it is we're talking about political rights, socioeconomic rights, etc. Adala, the human rights organizations that deal with these issues, counts more than 50 Israeli laws that discriminate against Palestinians in Israel. Legal discrimination also could be found on most areas, in most areas. And just to give you some statistics, on the socioeconomic situation, we can see that 53% of the Palestinians in Israel are under poverty line. Now, that means that they should get more welfare spending. But if we calculate welfare spending per capita, we can see that it is 30% less than the national average. And since we are in a university, we can just also look at what's happening in Israeli universities, and we can see that, for example, on the level of tenured and tenure-track positions in Israeli universities for faculty members, only 1.75% of these positions have Palestinians working in universities in these positions. And the question here is not only a domestic question. We can see in this press conference that took place in February, in this press conference, the theme of the Jewish state and Jewish democratic state was emphasized a lot by both speakers, President Clinton and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Sorry, President Trump, not Clinton. even Benjamin Netanyahu presented the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, as a condition for peace, and demanded that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state. But this is not only, you know, the object of obsession of right-wing politicians like Trump and Netanyahu. 2 months earlier, in December, former Secretary of State John Kerry had a press conference about the peace process in the Middle East, where he highlighted the question of, or the issue of Israel being a Jewish and democratic state, and then he also added that Israel being a Jewish and democratic state is one of the main goals of the peace process. Now, how is this definition justified? If we look at the mainstream justifications, if we look at how many theorists, and indeed also how the Supreme Court deals with the definition, we can see that the contradictions between the two elements are either watered down, or even statements saying that there's no contradiction at all. And this justification rests on a distinction between two ideas. The first idea is the idea of the nation, which is the, and in this case it's the Jewish nation, which is understood as the ethnic slash religious group which exercises self-determination within the state. So this idea on one hand, on the other hand, the idea of the people. The people being the citizenry. So everybody who is a citizen, who's allowed or has the right to vote, is seen as belonging to the people. So we can see here that, you know, the people is a broader category. It includes everybody who has citizenship, but the nation is a narrower one where it's only people who have certain characteristics of belonging to the particular group. And the state, as a nation state, as a state that reflects self-determination of a particular nation, is justified in granting favorable treatment to those who belong to the nation, as long as basic equality among individual members of the people is observed. Now, this distinction and this argument actually is problematic on a number of levels. And just to name a few, it just creates hierarchy among citizens for those who belong to the nation and those who do not belong, the insiders and the outsiders. And it also reflects a narrow approach to democracy and equality that makes equality subordinate to the interests of the Jewish majority and ignores social, historic, and economic realities. And it keeps Palestinians necessarily in a compromised position. So what I do is I look to constitutional theory in order to have a better understanding of what we mean by the people. Because simply positing and arguing that everybody who has citizenship is essentially part of the people, I think is a way of ignoring some serious questions and ignoring some serious realities. And modern constitutional theory views the people as a central component of the constitutional order. So democratic states usually base their legitimacy on the consent and acceptance of the people. And the constitution is often regarded as representative of the will of the people who, through the constitution, create the norms and the institutions that shape the legal order. And in this sense, the people are thought of as the authors of the constitution. And it comes as no surprise that many constitutions have in the preamble reference to the people. Now, this is very important because the people are seen as the ones who exercise sovereignty in its internal sense, who have what's known as constituent power, so the power to create, shape, and shape the constitution. And therefore, any assessment of democracy, in my opinion, should start, and democracy understood as self-governance, should start with the assessment of the self, with asking the question of who is included in the self or who is included in the people. And this is one of the themes of the book. So rather than uncritically accept that everybody who has the right to vote is part of the people, I investigate the question of who is the people based on the broader picture of the constitutional order. So the constitutional basic laws, important statutes, constitutional principles and norms, court decisions, and other aspects of the constitutional order. Now, this is one of the themes of the book. The second one is settler colonialism. So law in general, and constitutional law in particular, should be understood in its context. And I think in this context here, settler colonialism is one of the most important ways that will help us understand how the constitutional order produces such outcomes. Israel adopts many policies that could be described as settler colonial, where the state acts as the tool of a settler society in conflict with an indigenous population. Again, if we think about the story that I presented at the beginning, we can see that a clear example of settlement or settlers and displacing an indigenous population in order to secure the land. Well, settler societies or settler states have settler societies that are distinct from the native population. And the settler societies and the settler states really seek to control the land and the resources to establish their own economy and mode of governance. And this is the story of the Zionist movement and Zionist colonization since the 19th century. Patrick Wolfe, the historian and anthropologist, explains that the dominant feature of settler colonialism is not the exploitation of the native population, but rather the replacement of the native population. Its logic being the logic of elimination, which does not necessarily have to be violent or physical, but it could also be or could also have different ways of elimination, for example, by forced or coerced assimilation, which targets the cultural identity or political identity or the heritage or the institution of the native population. Patrick Wolfe also describes settler colonialism as having positive and negative dimensions. Negatively, it strives for the dissolution of the native society. Positively, it erects a new colonial society on the expropriated land base. So in my book, I look at how settler colonialism shapes the development of Israeli constitutional law, and how law, in turn, regenerates the logic of settler colonialism by establishing and reinforcing the settler nation and dissolving the native population. And based on these two themes, I ask the question of who is the people. And through this, I examine the definition of the state as Jewish and democratic, and how this definition is entrenched, maintained, and constantly regenerated in the constitutional order. Now, for the remaining time, I'm just going to look at some of the themes that I look at in the book. And the first one is the Declaration of Establishment of the State of Israel. And this declaration was essentially the first legal act of the state. It is the legal act that created the state from the law's point of view. It has, of course, as such, has significant importance. It plays a role in constitutional and legal interpretation. And there are a number of cases where actually you can see that it played really an important role. But what I'm going to do today is just take a look at some aspects of this text and try to see, based on the narratives presented, who is actually the people. And if we look at some of the themes here and some of the narrative presented, we can see that the declaration erects the settler society as the people. And you can see that here it basically highlights the importance of Jewish immigration, how it is described. We can see that the settlers were presented as pioneers, defenders, that they made the desert bloom, revived the Hebrew language, built villages and towns, created thriving communities, and also, very importantly, actually, the claim of bringing the blessings of progress to all the country's inhabitants, which is also another colonial theme. Now, we can see that here, in this narrative presented, we can see that the positive dimension of settler colonialism, of creating the settler society in this narrative. And, of course, we can see also how the Palestinians are treated in this text. So if we contrast all the description in the earlier text of the deeds and the virtues of the settlers, on the other hand, we can see how the Palestinians, or of course here described as only the Arabs, how they enter the text only really in the form of people who are attacking. And there's also a conditional invitation to join the state as citizens, but of course it is conditional upon preserving the peace and participating in the state building if you preserve the peace and agree to the narrative of the declaration. But we can see here that the people here, as a matter of theory and practice really, is exclusively the Jewish citizens of the state. and this conditional invitation did not tolerate any other narrative in this context. And this declaration actually is getting more and more prominent because it was included in the basic laws that were enacted in the 1990s, and also any discussion of creating a full and formal constitution of Israel always has the declaration of the state as the starting point. Another theme I look at is the citizenship and immigration laws. Because once the state was formed, it was under pressure to grant equal universal citizenship in order to legitimize itself internationally. And of course, this was especially important in the context of a state that whose legitimacy is continuously questioned. on the other hand, the state was the product of the Zionist movement. And of course, the state cannot really disconnect itself from the history and the roots of, and the founding ideologies, which highlighted the issues of Jewish majority and Jewish sovereignty as ultimate goals. So creating and maintaining a Jewish majority meant the removal of the Palestinians, and it still means the restriction of their growth to ensure that the numbers do not become high enough to threaten the political power of the Jewish majority. Now, the immigration and citizenship policies and laws oscillated between these two poles. So on the one hand, we have the law of return, which grants citizenship to anybody who is Jewish or close family of a Jewish person, which not only provides automatic citizenship, but also provides significant financial incentives for the right kind of people to immigrate, which includes paying the airfare, cash in hand at the airport, and other privileges. On the other hand, when it comes to Palestinians, they were offered a measure of inclusion through formal citizenship, which was granted in 1952, which was available to a minority of Palestinians who used to live in the area that became Israel, because the majority, about 80 or 85%, were expelled or fled in the war of 1948. But still, at the same time, the state takes measures to reduce the availability of citizenship to Palestinians through, for example, the citizenship and immigration, citizenship and entry to Israel law, which makes it almost impossible for Palestinians who are Israeli citizens to sponsor spouses, sponsor Palestinian spouses if those spouses live or are from the occupied Palestinian territories. So the outcome of this system that is designed to benefit the Jewish majority at the expense of the native minority and maintain numerical preponderance of the majority so that the state would continue being a Jewish state. Another important aspect is is political participation or political representation. So Israel has universal franchise, and all citizens have the right to vote, and all citizens also have the right to run for office or participate in elections. But also we have Section 7A of Basic Law of the Knesset, which is one of the constitutional basic laws that regulate the work of the Knesset. And here we can see that this law has all kind of stipulations. And Section 7 says that any person or a person shall not be a candidate, and also the list cannot participate if the goals or actions of the list or the person expressly or by implications include one of the following. And the first one is negation of the existence of the state of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. Now, this section is used very often by the Central Elections Committee in order to exclude Palestinian individuals and sometimes entire parties from participation. The trend has been also that all these, or this decision to ban these individuals or lists, has been overturned by the Supreme Court because of the interpretation that the Supreme Court adopted, but also, and more significantly, because of the evidentiary threshold, the very high evidentiary threshold that the court has adopted, which makes the assessment of whether it falls within Section 7A or not more complex. But still, at the same time, the very existence of this section is important, because essentially what it does is just sets the red lines about where political activism and political discourse should stop. So, and by doing so, it restricts Palestinian citizens as political actors and acts as gatekeeper for who and which ideas are allowed to enter the Knesset. And it essentially ensures that the rules that establish Zionist hegemony cannot be changed democratically and distances the Palestinian citizens from the center of power within the state. Similar dynamics could be seen in constitution making and lawmaking. So we have, for example, in constitution making or constitutional amendment, there is a principle which was introduced through the case law that says that the definition or the values of the state as a Jewish and democratic state are unamendable, which means that if the Knesset, for example, wants to amend the basic laws to remove this definition, and there's a majority for this measure, then this is should be seen as unconstitutional. Also, it plays a role in legal interpretation, in lawmaking. So the rules of procedure of the Knesset have a rule that says that you cannot introduce legislation that is contrary to the definition as Jewish and democratic state. Legal interpretation is also relevant because the values of the state as Jewish and democratic are seen as presumptions in any act of legal interpretation. And also it plays an important role in judicial review of legislation because according to the limitation clause of basic law, human dignity and freedom, and basic law, freedom of occupation, legislation has to be in line or befit the values of the state as Jewish and democratic state. So we can see here that the definition plays an important role at a number of levels. And we can see that it actually functions at different stages to exclude Palestinian citizens from the processes of generating and exercising political power. In essence, the definition acts as a filter at different stages to ensure that whatever rights the Palestinian citizens have to influence the system are, to a large extent, neutralized. The outcome is that the power to establish, shape, and influence the constitutional order is concentrated exclusively in the hands of Jewish citizens, despite the formal citizenship of the Palestinian citizens. In essence, the Palestinians do not partake in the sovereignty or the constituent power that the people exercises. In this sense, they are excluded from the people. And this exclusion, in many ways, is the result of the logic of settler colonialism, which has influenced the development of the law to achieve certain outcomes. And essentially here, what these findings tell us about the nature of Israeli democracy or democracy in Israel. Because if we accept that in a democracy the people is sovereign and that the people exercises this sovereignty through creating the constitutional order and through elections, the finding that 20% of the citizens who are a distinct indigenous group are not part of the people has significant implications. It essentially breaks the reflexive identity between the governors and the governed. And in this sense, Israel cannot be seen as a democracy for the Palestinian citizens, for they are only part of the governed and not part of the governors. And this begs another question, which is democracy divisible? Can a state or a regime be democratic for one group and non-democratic for others? Or can democracy within the tribe, as Azmi Bshara puts it, be seen as democracy in the state? And in this context, my view is that universality is one of the central features of democracy and its moral impetus. The impulse of universal equal treatment is what maintains the internal morality of the idea of democracy. And as such, the nature of the regime in Israel cannot be seen as truly democratic. Now, the themes that I discuss in the book, which highlight a number of constitutional areas or how areas where how the definition affects the constitutional ordering, are not also only intended to identify the problems, but also identifying the problems could also help in identifying some of the solutions or provide some kind of mapway or roadmap to democratization. Unfortunately, the situation is actually getting worse and heading in the opposite direction. We can see this in multiple legislation or acts in the Knesset, the composition of the Knesset, bills that are being discussed, and also we can see it in the composition of the Supreme Court of Israel, where two of the Supreme Court judges are now settlers who live in the illegal settlements in the West Bank. So sorry to leave you with this negative note, but I think we can have more discussion afterwards. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Masri, for that stimulating and worrisome presentation of your book. Next, we'll hear from Professor Yoav Peled, who will serve as the discussant. Thank you. You will speak for about 20 minutes, is that correct?
Sure. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Hanin, for organizing this event and inviting me to take part in it. First, I would like to say that Dr. Masri's book is a very good book and a very important book. It's the first book since David Kretschmer's book published in 1990 that deals comprehensively with the legal or constitutional situation of Israel's Palestinian citizens. And I think he does it very well. So I don't have any major criticism of the general argument of the book, and also not of the way that the argument is being substantiated by the material. I have two minor critical points that I would like to make, and I would like to use these two points in order to broaden the context in which I think the book or the argument of the book should be seen. This is not by way of criticism of the book. The book, I think, does very well what it set out to do, but I think there is some value in viewing it in a broader context. My first critical point has to do with this article, this famous Article 7A or Section 7A that Dr. Masri just talked about. And he devotes a lot of space in the book to discussing. And everything he says is correct, of course, but I think there's another aspect which is underplayed, not exactly ignored, but underplayed in the book about Article 7A, and that is the fact that, on the one hand, it is true, this article sets up Israel's Palestinian citizens as second-class citizens, there's no question about it. A political party cannot contest Knesset elections if it denies on the gates the nature of Israel as a Jewish state, and of course, this is what the Palestinian citizens would like to do. This is exactly what they would like to do, and they cannot do it. So in that sense, not only in that sense, but in that sense, they are clearly secondary. However, Article 7A also protects the citizenship of Israel's Palestinian citizens as secondary citizenship. Secondary citizenship is preferable to non-citizenship, as we can see just if we look a few kilometers eastward from wherever we are, not here, but if we were in Israel now, then we see the huge difference between being a citizen and being a non-citizen. And Article 7A protects the citizenship, such as it is, of Israel's Palestinian citizens. And this is manifested at least in two ways. One is what Dr. Masri just mentioned, and that is the fact that no Palestinian political party has been disqualified on the basis of Article 7A so far. On the other hand, Jewish political parties have been disqualified on the basis of Article 7A, but for denying the democratic character of the state and inciting to racism. The first was Kach, Rabbi Meir Kahana's political party, and then some descendants of him also were disqualified. So with everything that Dr. Masri said being true, still the fact is that only Jewish political parties have been disqualified so far. I don't know how long this will go on. I think we are nearing the point where Palestinian political parties will be disqualified, but so far this hasn't happened. So this is one element or one fact that expresses the fact that the citizenship of the Palestinian citizens is also protected by Article 7A. The other point is, if you look at who was disqualified and who wasn't disqualified in 1988 on the basis of Article 7A, I'm talking about right now only about the Jewish parties. So Kahana's party, Kach, was disqualified. Another political party that called for the transfer of Palestinians, but only the non-citizens, named Moledet, headed by this guy euphemistically called Gandhi, who was later assassinated by a Palestinian, it was not disqualified. Why was Kach disqualified and Moledet not disqualified? Because Kach called for the transfer of all Palestinians from the Israeli control system, while Moledet only called for the transfer of the non-citizens. In other words, Kach infringed on the citizenship, or he did not infringe, wanted to infringe on the citizenship of Israel's Palestinian citizens, and that's why it was qualified. Moledet did not try to do that with respect to the citizens, and that's why it was not disqualified. It was allowed to contest the elections and actually did win, I don't remember how many seats, I think one seat in the Knesset in that election. So that's why I'm saying that Article 7A, with all of the negative aspects of it, also has this positive point, that it protects the nature of the citizenship that Israel's Palestinian citizens do have. And there are other alternatives which are a lot worse. So if this is what Article 7A does, what does it tell us about the nature of the Israeli state? There is a debate going on right now, has been going on for a number of years, between two schools of thought. One is called Ethnic Democracy, developed by Professor Sami Smucha, who I'm very happy to see sitting with us right now. And the other one is called Ethnocracy, developed by Professor Oren Iftachel. And I will just present each model in a few words. The ethnic democracy model says that Israel indeed is a nationalizing state in Roses Brubaker's terms, and it is a state owned by the Jews. Like Dr. Masri said, the people in we the people are the Jewish people. There's no question about it. However, ethnic democracy still meets the formal requirements of procedural democracy as formulated by every democratic theorist, every major democratic theorist, Robert Dahl, for example, and I think Dr. Masri also pointed it out. Certainly, there is no equality in ethnic democracy, but there is a common basis of citizenship rights that is common to all, that everybody shares. So this is ethnic democracy, and Professor Smucha is arguing that this can be called a democracy as long as there is a political space in which the minority, the Palestinian citizens in this case, can struggle lawfully to improve their situation under the glass ceiling of this being an ethnic democracy. So this is ethnic democracy. Ethnocracy says, ethnocracy is a non-democratic rule by one ethnic group over the other. And this is the argument that is made by Professor Iftachel. Now, is Israel an ethnic democracy or an ethnocracy? I would say that in the current debate, the question is a semantic question. In other words, there's no real debate. There's no real debate because the unit of analysis that each model refers to is a different unit of analysis. This, by the way, doesn't prevent the debate from going on. It is going on, but it is a semantic debate. Because the model of ethnic democracy refers to Israel within its pre-1967 borders, as does Dr. Masri's book. And the model of ethnocracy refers to the Israeli control system, which includes Israel and occupied Palestinian territories. And Professor Iftachel says very clearly, there is no such thing as Israel within its pre-1967 borders. This political entity simply doesn't exist, and therefore there's no point in talking about it. But of course, Dr. Masri's book does exactly that. Now, why do I bring this up? If this is only a semantic debate and no real debate, why do I even refer to it? And I refer to it because it connects to my second critical point, which I will say in a minute, and also because I believe that pre-1967 Israel, which I think as a unit of analysis is valid, is a valid unit of analysis for certain purposes, but still I think it cannot really be understood without the connection to the control system to the occupied Palestinian territories. So the second critical point is it has to do with the citation that Dr. Masri showed from Aaron Barak, former Chief Justice of Israel. In that famous and I think potentially earth-shaking Kaadan decision. In the Kaadan decision, Barak said, among many other things, and this is not mentioned in the book, and I think this is a point that I would like to criticize, that it is not mentioned in the book. Among the many things that Barak says, and we all know, or at least many of us know, Barak is a Zionist, Barak is a Holocaust survivor. For him, the state being a Jewish state is the highest value. There's no question about that. But he said in this Kaadan decision, in his opinion, in the Kaadan decision, which of course was the main opinion, that the principle of equality trumps the legitimate interest of the state in Judaizing the space. In other words, Judaizing the space, Judaizing the country, in Barak's view, is a legitimate state interest. However, this legitimate state interest is trumped by the principle of equality. And that's why Barak decided that in the world, everybody familiar with this case knows that the state cannot discriminate between Jews and non-Jews in the allocation of state land. Of course, there's a lot of criticism. All the state land was Palestinian land and so on and so on. But still, given the entire context, I think this statement, this point, this argument is potentially earth-shaking. Now, Barak also said, relying on the famous Brown versus Board of Education decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, that there is no such thing as separate but equal. Separate is inherently unequal. Now, this had a potential of being a revolutionary decision. Many, many people, many, many opponents of the decisions, many of whom are mentioned in Dr. Masri's book, immediately jumped up and said, this is the end of the Jewish state. What is the meaning of the Jewish state if the state cannot discriminate between Jews and non-Jews in the allocation of state lands? What is the conflict all about? The conflict is about land. And if the state cannot favor the Jews, cannot privilege the Jews in the allocation of land, land, by the way, in Israel, if there's anybody who doesn't know that, is not privately owned. It's 93% of it is state-owned, and you can only lease it. You cannot buy it. So the question of state allocation of land is a crucial question. So if the state cannot privilege the Jews in allocating state land, what does it mean that it's a Jewish state? It will not be a Jewish state anymore. And I think they were right. I think they were right. And I hoped it would really go that way. Unfortunately, it did not go that way. And it did not go that way for a reason that illustrates my other point, which is that Israel in its pre-67 borders cannot be understood completely without reference to the entire control system, to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Because why didn't the Qadan decision turn out to be a revolutionary decision? Why wasn't it really an earth-shaking decision? Because a few months later, the Second Intifada broke out. The Qadan decision was in May, and the Second Intifada, of course, broke out at the end of September. And because of the Second Intifada, and because of the October events, which were the response of Israel's Palestinian citizens to the brutal repression of the Second Intifada, even in its very, very first days by the Israeli military, that changed the picture completely. Completely. The whole era of the 1990s was an era of liberalization in Israel. First and foremost, economic liberalization, but also liberalization in many other spheres of social life, including the attitude of the states towards the Palestinian citizens. The Palestinian citizens of Israel themselves say that the second Rabin administration from 1992 until he was assassinated in 1995 was the best period for the Palestinian citizens of Israel ever. Then everything changed, but this period was the best period, was the most liberal period, and the Qadan decision, I think, was the highlight of that period, but unfortunately, it was also the swan song of that period because of the Second Intifada and the October events that came with it. Now, many, many of the points that Dr. Masri makes correctly in the book about the demographic concerns of the Jews and the state regarding the Palestinians, they would have looked totally differently if there was not the occupied Palestinian territories, because there's a huge difference if you talk about a Palestinian population of 1.5 million or 4.5 million, and as the chances for a two-state solution are disappearing, then the demographic reality is of 4.5 million Palestinians, and that, of course, affects the way the state reacts to that. The question of security. Of course, security has a totally different meaning, gained a totally different meaning after the Second Intifada. And this law that prohibits family unification between between Israeli citizens and non-citizens from the occupied territories, that law was justified on security grounds. I don't think this justification held any water, but never mind. It was justified on that ground, but it could not have been justified on that ground if not for the Second Intifada and the suicide bombings that characterized it. So I'm not saying all of this, of course, in order to blame the Palestinians in the occupied territories for the situation of the Palestinian citizens, of course not. But I'm saying that this cannot be viewed separately. So I'm saying something that's a little complicated, maybe. I think Israel in its pre-1967 is a valid unit of analysis for certain purposes, and for the purposes of Dr. Masri's book, it's definitely a legitimate and valid unit of analysis. Still, this unit of analysis, I don't think, can be analyzed fully without taking into notice the broader system of which it is a part, which is the control system, namely Israel and the Palestinian occupied territories. And just one word to try to end on an optimistic note. If you were suggesting a solution, I think the solution really presents itself from this analysis, and that is make one state of the entire area. Extend Israeli citizenship to the Palestinians in the occupied territories, which are, in fact, incorporated into Israel for the past 50 years. And I think this will, of course, not something that we can expect next week, but if we even begin to think in that direction, if we begin to act moving in that direction, I think this is the only ray of hope that we can see in this situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Peled. We have 25 minutes for questions and answers. I have a first question, unless somebody is dying to pose the first question. Any questions from the House? Yes, I see one.
Yeah, I have a question.
Do you mind introducing yourself?
My name is Ian Black, and I'm at the Middle East Center at LSE. I'm curious that neither of you mentioned something which I thought was, I think is, quite central to the argument. Forgive me if I missed it, but it seems to me that in terms of the relationship between Israel before 1967 and after 1967, the element that really links the two periods and is analytically useful is the existence of a military government inside Israel, or the then Palestinian minority of what was at the beginning, 160,000 at the beginning, rising. So until 1966, until just a few months before the 1967 war, when so much changed, you had a system of blatant discrimination against Israel's Arab citizens. Now, I've always been struck, and struck even more so, not by the, obviously 1967 constitutes an important moment of change, a rupture of enormous significance, but in terms of Israeli attitudes towards the Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line, surely it constitutes an element of great continuity. And that, I'm just curious to hear about how you think that the great watershed of 1967 affected the situation inside Israel as well.
This is why the historian Amnon Rice Krakotskin, who's, I'm sure you're familiar with him, he said that the Jewish and democratic state only lasted for 8 months between the abolition of the military administration and 1967. Yes, so you're absolutely correct. I think that you cannot talk about Israel as an ethnic democracy before the abolition of the military administration. So only from 1966 on, you can talk about Israel as a democracy of any kind.
Would you like to respond? Yes.
So the military government was there for a reason, to achieve certain outcomes, which is to control the population. And this system of control, actually, especially in the late 50s and the early 60s, proved to be actually too expensive, too bureaucratic, too cumbersome. And the many people in the security establishment reached the conclusion that they can actually do the same control, have the same method of control without having it through military government. In addition to this, the very existence of the military administration, military government, was a source of embarrassment for the state, because it was mentioned a lot in the UN. Many governments raised it. And also at the same time, there were many people, even on the right. For example, one of the people who always raised the question was Begin, who's the, you know, one of the founders of the Likud party, or what was known then as Herut. So the reason it was eliminated was the high costs, and we can do just get the same results, achieve the same results, without having it, without having the also reputational damage of having this, you know, formal, full-fledged apartheid system. The difference when it comes to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip is that if you want to abide by international law, you cannot impose Israeli law. So what you can do is military control, because essentially the effective control is in the hand of the military. And the only thing you can do is continue the same legal system, and in addition to whatever the military commander deems important for the welfare of the population and for security purposes. So essentially the only way to govern it without having the additional, you know, international costs was military government. And you can see actually that many of the military orders that established the military government in the West Bank were copy-pasted from the military government in the that was imposed on the Palestinians inside Israel. So I think there's a lot here. So there's continuity, but also we need to bear in mind also the realities that led to dissolving military control or military government in pre 1967 and the creation and establishment in post 1967.
Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Masri. Is secondary citizenship preferable to non-citizenship?
It depends on really the options. Now, I think this question is dangerous. Now, if I'm asked, do you want to, let's say, be killed or paralyzed, I probably will think about it for 2 days. But then also at the same time, the options are kind of really, I don't think either are good. But in a way also, the problem with this question is that it sets up a race to the bottom, really. So instead of trying to improve the situation by saying, well, full citizenship versus some measure of citizenship, we're just going downhill and asking, well, it's better than nothing. So, and the cup half empty debate, I'm in the half empty, because the half full is always going to make us really be happy with whatever we have, and we'll probably stop efforts, struggle to actually get the full cup.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a question there.
Yeah. My name is Sana, and I do master's in international strategy and diplomacy here. I'm actually a Palestinian citizen of Israel, so this applies very much to me. Thank you for the insightful presentations. I have one comment and one question. My comment actually goes with what you just asked, Dr. Master. I think When I hear that, I mean, saying that a second-class citizen or partial citizenship is better than a full one.
Than no citizenship.
I'm sorry?
It's better than no citizenship.
Or than no citizenship, I'm sorry. It equals to me with a lot of statements made to us saying, oh, say thank you that you have that Israeli ID, say thank you you have Israeli passport. And I think it's not only dangerous, it's kind of somebody telling you we are doing you a favor that you're here, and just say be grateful about it, which is I'm saddened to hear it. Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East, that the only comparison should be to a real full democracy, not to any other rule which is less than democracy. My question is about the law, the basic law 7A, Article 2, about criticism and incitement. You give, Professor Pellet, you give an example of Jewish parties that were disqualified by it, but not any Arab parties, to say that it actually protects the Israeli Arab political participation. Now, my question is, having witnessed so many racist and incitement statements by Knesset members like or ministers like the education, clearly in the last campaign, I have blood on my hands, and I killed Arab, and I don't regret it, or the Prime Minister saying that the Palestinians are running in masses to vote as if were a threat, or Abdan in Umm al-Hiran kind of inciting against the Yaqub. Yeah. I mean, how do you see that law actually apply? How do you see the fact that it's not applied when it comes to Jewish parliament members, when we have such a harsh racist statement made against, what you presented as.
Thank you. I'll take one more question, if there are any in the room. Professor.
Okay, well, first, the law is something very specific. Any law is something very specific. This law is not a law against racist incitement. There is a law against racist incitement, and of course it is not applied when, in most cases, in almost no cases, it's applied to Jews. That's true. But this law does something very specific. It tells you on what basis the Central Elections Commission can disqualify a political party from participating in Knesset elections. So all those racist incitement has to be in the platform of the party, or it has to be part of the party's campaign for it to qualify under this article. Now, of course, the reality is that there's tremendous amount of racism against Palestinians in Israel. There's no question about that. But this has to fall into that very specific category. Now, this has to do with your comment. I think that, leaving normative considerations aside and looking just at the practicality of things, I think it's incumbent upon us to look at both sides of this picture. Israeli control system has two separation lines. It is a separation line that distinguishes between citizens and non-citizens, and there is another separation line that distinguishes between Jewish citizens and Palestinian citizens. Both of them are very, very important. And I think to understand the reality, leaving aside how you feel in this situation or that, or what you think about it normatively, but to understand the reality of life there, you have to consider both lines. And the fact that the line that distinguishes citizens from non-citizens exists, and I think it's very meaningful. I don't want to tire everybody by giving all kinds of examples why it is significant. It makes the situation of the Palestinian citizens immeasurably better than the situation of the non-Palestinian citizens. I'm not saying this is justified. I'm not saying it's justified, of course. The only just situation would have been total equality, including everybody, in my view. But that's not what we have, so we have to look at what we have and try to assess what we have. And if we do that, I think it would be very, very hard to argue that Palestinian citizenship in Israel is not a meaningful citizenship, being secondary, of course, but also a meaningful citizenship which enables the Palestinian citizens to do and achieve things which are inconceivable for the Palestinians who are not citizens.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Can I add?
Yes, you could.
Yeah, so I agree with Professor Pellet that there is a line that marks the citizenship. So the citizenship is a line, it's real, it exists, and distinguishes between Palestinians who are Israeli citizens and Palestinians who are not Israeli citizenship, have Israeli citizenship. And that there are differences in terms of the rights and the level of protection. But one thing I just also want to highlight here is the reason for the existence of this line and the existence of this distinction, and also to bring it back to some of the comments that Professor Pellet made about Section 7A and the question of having incitement to racism as grounds for disqualification. Because I think the existence of this line and the distinction, and also having race incitement to racism as grounds for banning participation in the elections, is meant first and foremost, actually, to protect the system itself. Because when Kahana was in the Knesset, actually, it was a source of embarrassment. And most of the members of Knesset actually disliked him. They boycotted him. They left the Knesset when he left the hall when he went to give speeches, etc. And the reason is that his racism is actually real, clear, and open, with very open goals of eliminating, displacing, expelling all Palestinians. But then, if expulsion, so what is there a huge difference between somebody who calls for expulsion and somebody calls for the state to pay the Palestinians money to leave? I think this line of distinction is really minor. Or a distinction between somebody who calls for expulsion or calls for an exchange of inhabited territories, where areas where Palestinians live could be, for example, transferred to the West Bank or to a future Palestinian state. So I think both reflect racism. The fact that one is really on the reflects, you know, excessive situation of racism, which is in the Israeli context is seen as beyond the pale, is just a semantic point, because racism really here is at the core of these policies, whether it's advocates outright expulsion or doing it through other means. Similarly, also, we need to bear in mind the international context. So Section 7A, the question of incitement, of course, is very important when it comes to international context, because I don't think the Israeli government wants headlines or wants news reports talking about people who are introducing race laws. But then if you introduce race laws in a very indirect way, then it's hard to actually discuss them in that context. The same thing also, one of the main reasons I also believe that Section 7A was not used, or let's say all of the attempts to use Section 7A against Palestinian parties and individuals were overturned by the court, is because the court also can look at it from the point of view of international community, especially that now we have international and globalized judicial networks where judges continuously meet every year, they have conferences, they look at each other's practices, case law. If you look at the level, for example, of citations, foreign citations, in the decisions of most major Supreme Courts, we see that there's always borrowing and measuring and taking from other decisions. So the rise of the area of comparative constitutional law is very important. Because if you have a country and a Supreme Court where basically if somebody says, I want the state to be the state of all of its citizens, which is probably the bare minimum of liberal democracy, and if the court comes and says, no, you can't participate in the elections, it will be impossible, really, to say that this state is democratic. And this Supreme Court will bring upon itself significant reputational damage. It will lose any credibility. So there is also the international context that we need to bear in mind in this context.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? I have another question. You concluded your talk, Dr. Masri, by saying Israel is not a democracy for the Palestinians. What would it take for Israel to become a democracy?
Well, there's two things here that need to be discussed. The first one is that the settler colonialism, which because of the limited time, I didn't have enough time to elaborate on it, should be taken seriously. So it's not just a matter of textual changes in legislation. There's also a need to change in the mindset, to change the way of thinking in a manner that eliminates, actually, settler colonialism. So it's not only about legislation, I think, or law. I think law is reflective of this logic of settler colonialism. So the first step is to tackle the question of settler colonialism, to the question of distinction between native and settler, and the idea that settler population could be or should be given extra rights or extra privileges, and the way that this also translates into law. So this should be the first step. Mm-hmm. And I think once there's serious consideration of these questions, that will open up prospects for democratization.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Are there any questions now? Well, before concluding the event, first of all, thank you very much to our speakers and our audience. I think they deserve a round of thanks. And thank you very much to Hanin Namne for having organized this event, who is standing at the very back. We have sandwiches outside. Before you disperse, I would like to remind you that there are two events organized by the Center for the Study of Human Rights that are coming up. One is on March 31st. It's called Priority Setting in NGOs, Learning Across Human Rights, Humanitarianism, and Conservation. And the second one will be held on April 25th, called Global Civil Law, Solidarity by Proxy, by Professor Susan Buck-Morse of City University of New York. So we hope to see you at those events as well. So thank you very much once again.